listening to In Layman's Terms, a podcast dedicated to stories of discipleship, news from the United Methodist Church, and lessons from Scripture. I'm your host, Todd Seifert, and as the Communications Director in the Great Plains Conference and a certified lay minister in the UMC, it's my privilege to share these reflections with you. The United Methodist Church's General Conference finally convenes April 23rd in Charlotte, North Carolina, 8 years after concluding its last regular session in 2016. Much has happened since that last gathering, including a worldwide pandemic, disaffiliations of about 25% of the denomination's U.S. churches over concerns about inclusion of LGBTQ plus persons in the life of the church, and of course there have been other issues worldwide. This gathering in 2024, which has the name 2020 in it because this is indeed the postponed 2020 General Conference, will address many issues. But amid those many topics, three have risen to the top in the minds of many people. They are, first, removal of restrictive language, some people would call it harmful language, from the Book of Discipline regarding LGBTQ plus persons. Second is regionalization, which is a process meant to provide flexibility and better equity across the denomination. And third is the revision of the denomination's social principles, which are statements of stances the denomination takes on current events and concerns. It's the first major revision to this document in decades. Now, originally, I'd intended to take one episode for each of those topics, but all three of them are so intertwined that it felt like separating them left out important context from each of my guests. So instead, you're going to have the opportunity to binge just a little bit. We'll have 5 episodes about the upcoming General Conference. You'll hear discussions between myself and Reverends Adam Hamilton, Mark Holland, Amy Lippolt, and David Livingston, as well as Great Plains Conference lay leader Lisa Maupin. In each case, we'll address their thoughts on those three subjects, known to many as the three R's. We'll kick things off with my discussion with Reverend Mark Holland, one of the co-founders of Mainstream UMC, a group that has set its own priorities to help guide the future of the church. Besides the three goals mentioned a moment ago, they also hope to end the movement of disaffiliation from the denomination. Mark met with me a few weeks ago at Old Mission United Methodist Church in Fairway, Kansas. Here's our discussion. Mark, why don't you start off telling us about the organization that you work with and what it's doing as we prepare for General Conference.
Yeah, thanks, Todd. It's Mainstream UMC, and we began, co-founded it. I co-founded it with Reverend Dr. Nanette Roberts, who's now retired. She was the pastor at Grace United Methodist in Olathe. She and I co-founded Mainstream UMC to serve as a, really to run the campaign to get the One Church plan passed in 2019. So we founded it July 1, 2018. We had 8 months to put out publicity materials, communicate with delegates, really moved forward. And so we put together a team that first summer and an advisory board that has now grown. We have about 23 members of our advisory board. And we recruited delegates from around the connection. So mostly U.S.-based. We do have a delegate from Africa, and we have one delegate from Europe. But we have all 5 jurisdictions represented. And really, Mainstream UMC is a lot based on its name. We actually borrowed the name from a group, a political group in Johnson County called Mainstream Coalition that works across the aisle in Topeka for kind of mainstream, trying to break through the polarization in Kansas politics, which is no easy feat. And I was actually on the board of Mainstream, and I liked the vision of working left and right of center. And we say this at Mainstream UMC all the time. We can work with people who are left and right of center, but if you can't see the center from where you're standing, you might be standing in the wrong place. So that's why we chose that name and made it Mainstream UMC. Only people in Kansas City get confused. Folks around the country, it stands out. So that's how we got started and who we are. We stopped after with COVID, and we have restarted effective last May, pushing for regionalization. Really, we have 3 priorities, and I can go into that in a little bit. But Mainstream is an organization founded in the Great Plains, and working globally now to move the General Conference forward.
You talked a little bit just before we went on air here about your travels. I don't want to have you go into a lot of detail, but just tell me some of the places that you've been in recent months.
Well, I've been all over. For the One Church plan, I traveled to 17 different annual conferences. And this time, I've been several places in Great Plains, both Kansas and Nebraska. I've been down to Dallas and to Austin, Texas. I'll be out in Albuquerque this weekend, New Mexico. I have been to Indiana, Nashville, Virginia, Washington, D.C. I'll be in Miami speaking next week. So been in many places around the country, and I've done a number. Those are the in-person events I've done, and I'm also doing a lot of Zoom communications, as you might imagine.
Zoom is probably your friend right now.
Zoom is my friend as well.
Yeah. That idea of being in the center and trying to connect people on both sides, that is something that, frankly, we've lost a little bit in U.S. politics in general. And as we've learned in this entire process with the United Methodist Church, this is a political process.
That's right.
What have been some of the obstacles that you've seen as you've done your work? Let's just call it what it was. The 2019 special session of General Conference, pretty much a dumpster fire.
Yes.
I don't think too many people would actually argue with my assessment of that. Yep. Ever since then, there's been kind of this tension. Disaffiliations have come up. There's kind of a perception among, I think, a lot of people that the denomination has more fully now embraced the concepts anyway of full inclusion since we've had so many people leave. But that's probably jumping the gun a little bit, isn't it? Because you still have people on the conservative side who are part of this. How do you work to try to keep all those folks, not necessarily together, but at least willing to listen to each other?
Well, we do it well, and I think you're right. I mean, we do it well in our families and in our local churches. You know, I ask everyone. I don't know what your Thanksgiving table looks like, but I know what mine does. And we have a way in our families of working with people with whom we disagree on a variety of issues. Not just working with, but loving and caring for. We do that well at the local church, and I've never pastored a church where everyone agreed with me. I have given everyone the opportunity to agree with me. Not everyone takes it, but at the local church, we care for each other. We people who disagree politically sing in the choir together, work at the food pantry together, worship together. We really do a good job locally, and I think that's true in our communities as well. We do well when we work together locally. It's really when it gets to the state and the national level where it breaks down. And I often paraphrase our Lord, where two or more are gathered, there will be politics also. And so we have seen the polarization at the national level in the church that mirrors the polarization in our country. And I would love for our church to be a witness, you know, going back to John 17, for unity, to be one with one another as Christ is one with God. And that call to unity is not some lukewarm sellout position that it's often characterized by the people on the extremes. It's actually a gospel position of holding together in the midst of disagreement. We point to the book of Acts. The first fight in the church was about circumcision. I don't know many churches in Great Plains that have split over the issue of circumcision, but it was the biggest issue in the book of Acts. The very first church fight was about 2,000 years of biblical interpretation and 2,000 years of tradition. And is it possible that some people will have one practice and some people will have another? And Peter and Paul came to the agreement early on that saved the church that yes, there can be different practices, different biblical interpretation, different practice in different regions that allows for the church to continue to make disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world.
And Scripture tells us that Peter and Paul did not get along on everything.
They did not get along on most things. And that's I think that's the crux of our calling for unity. So I had hoped that the United Methodist Church nationally would set an example, a countercultural example of unity. And instead, we have done exactly what happened in 1844. We have followed the divisions of the country. And in that time, it was around slavery, biblical interpretation. People believed that slavery was ordained by God. they were wrong, but they split the church over it. And now we have a disagreement over homosexuality that is simply the flashpoint. It's the face of the disagreements, but the body of disagreement is much deeper. So it's disappointing that the church has not shown a better witness, but we are where we are. And my message now is there's room for everyone in the church, and we need to love and care for one another. We're not all going to agree. We need to do the best we can to grow the church because the world needs Christ. And while we're spinning our wheels at General Conference, we're not providing a great witness for Christ.
Right. Unrest is not exactly what the world needs to see.
That's right. Point. That's what they're living in.
Your organization, and frankly, many others, have what have become known as the three R's as the goals for the upcoming General Conference. I want to walk through those three with you and just let you tell us a little bit about your perspective on them and the work that you're doing with them, and just the things that you've learned as you've talked to people, because let's just be honest, you've talked to way more people than I have. So the first one is, I think, what the average person probably thinks is the sole reason for the General Conference, and that is the removal of restrictive language from the Book of Discipline. Tell us a little bit about that and where you think things stand now as we get ready to go to Charlotte, North Carolina for General Conference.
So the three R's that the coalition is working on, which is a centrist progressive coalition, is the first is regionalization. The second is removal of the harmful language. And the third is adopting the revised social principles. At Mainstream, we have three goals that are similar to that. It's regionalization, removing the harmful language, and we do A and B. A is adopting the social principles, because the social principles, the revised social principles, removes the incompatibility language. And then the second part of removing the language are the 10 other paragraphs that have restrictions on LGBTQ persons. Mm-hmm. So it's part A and B, the revised social principles, and then really everything else, including repealing all the punitive measures of the traditional plan that were inserted in there in 2019. And then the third for Mainstream is really pushing an end of disaffiliations. And there, the WCA and Good News and really the Global Methodist Church desperately wants more disaffiliations. They want to continue to grow their church through churches leaving the United Methodist Church. And our position is pretty clear. There does not need to be another global or top-down model like 2553.
Mark's talking about paragraph 2553 in the Book of Discipline. This paragraph was added during the 2019 special session of General Conference as a means for churches to lead the denomination. It was largely supported by traditionalists as a means for more progressive churches to leave the denomination. But when the tide turned after that special session, it was used by many conservative-leaning churches to leave the UMC.
Every annual conference has the ability to, already has the authority in the discipline.
Yeah, it's already in the discipline.
It's already in the discipline to allow, and it needs to be a localized effort. Annual conferences that did not do disaffiliations well will need to manage that. Those of us like Great Plains that did a very good job managing that do not need to reopen it. And so I think it needs to be annual conference by annual conference. And a reminder, the annual conferences outside the United States have the same tools in the discipline to manage disaffiliations should they want them. And so that's a big piece that Mainstream is pushing, is to end disaffiliations.
One of the things that I think a lot of people don't quite understand, they have the concept in their minds, okay, we are a global church. We're a worldwide church. We have churches in Africa. We have churches in South Asia. We have churches in Europe. But maybe what that means doesn't hit home for people. And we might get into that as we talk through the rest of these. Let's take your list. We have the same things, but in a little different order. Let's talk about regionalization first. We hear a lot about how complicated that is, but the concept isn't complicated. It's the polity that will get us there that's the complication. So let's just talk about, to start with, what is the concept of regionalization? How will that help?
Well, we should note that the Methodist Church, and I say Methodist intentionally, not just United Methodist, the Methodist Church has always had a regional approach to governance. And governance is really what we're talking about. Prior to the 1980s, there were only about 8% of the delegates at General Conference who were from outside the United States. Because for generations, as churches outside the United States would grow, for a variety of reasons, would become autonomous. And the autonomous church movement was very common. So all of the churches in Mexico, Central America, South America are all autonomous Methodists. All the churches in China, Korea, Australia, all autonomous. In fact, of the 10 million Methodists, according to the World Council of Churches, the 10 million Methodists in Africa, half are autonomous and half are United Methodist. And that's because those churches that are autonomous everywhere in the world came of age prior to the 1980s. And then in the 1980s, we started to change and started to try global governance. So we started, instead of having churches become autonomous outside the U.S., we began adding them to the UMC. And I think there's three reasons for that. Two require varying levels of cynicism. But the first reason that churches chose to do that, or the church chose to do that, is we were a declining denomination. Starting in the 60s, the United Methodist Church, like all mainline churches in the United States, began to decline. So by adding people from outside the United States, we became a growing denomination again. The only good reason, really, for this was the United Methodist Church in the U.S. is predominantly white middle class, and adding global diversity is a richer, better church. But that was one reason. Becoming a growing denomination again was another. But the one that requires the highest level of cynicism is that there were some people at General Conference who realized these were some reliably conservative votes. And so that you could keep the U.S. church more conservative than you could have if it were U.S. only. So if you look at other denominations, the Lutherans, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, UCC, all have removed the prohibitions for ordination and marriage for LGBTQ persons 12 to 16 years ago. The United Methodist Church would have done that also if it were a U.S.-only vote. And so part of the consequence of being a global church and trying to run a democratically run global church is that the U.S. is the church is more conservative than the U.S. church would be.
It might be important to pause here for context. Of the 862 delegates to be seated for this general conference, about 55% are from the United States. And I think it's fairly safe to say that after the wave of disaffiliations, they largely reflect a center to left-leaning perspective. That said, there are still a large number of conservatives who are part of the United Methodist Witness. The other 45% of delegates come from Southeast Asia, largely the Philippines, Europe, and the continent of Africa. The delegates from outside the United States are largely viewed as having conservative viewpoints on many issues, though, as with the U.S. delegates, that does not hold true for all of the delegates from outside the United States.
Well, and there are two pieces that are pretty important. One is the United Methodist Church is the largest denomination in the world that ordains women that does not ordain gay and lesbian persons. We are also the largest denomination in the world that's still trying to do a global governance structure. The Catholic Church has a global governance structure, but it's not democratic. But the Lutherans, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, UCC all have churches outside the United States, but they have a U.S.-only structure, and then the churches outside the U.S. are autonomous, like our other Methodist autonomous churches. So we're trying to hold together this global governance, which we're finding is very challenging. Regionalization is really the answer to that. And we went to a part of it in 2012. 2012, the General Conference adopted Paragraph 101. And it was really a gift to the Central Conferences outside the U.S. that said churches outside the U.S. can adapt large swaths of the Book of Discipline for their regional context. Unfortunately, that is not reciprocated to the United States. And in part, it's because of our colonial structure. We have the U.S. church is considered the mothership, and all the others are satellites. And that is not a super helpful structure for this day and age. We need to remove that colonial structure, and regionalization does that. But the structure we have now, we recognized in 2012 that the U.S. should not be controlling churches outside the U.S., and that's when delegates, so it was 8% outside the U.S. in 1985. By 2012, it was about a third of the delegates for outside the U.S. Now it's 45%. In 4 years, it'll be 55%. And that's because we stepped in the churches outside the United States. The General Conference stepped in the voting because if you just ran straight numbers, the U.S. would have been a minority vote probably 10 years ago. So we are net globally, but because of the structure of the General Conference and this colonial structure, the U.S. still has 55% of the votes. The challenge with regionalization is it requires a two-thirds vote because it requires 8 constitutional amendments to decenter the U.S. church. Those constitutional amendments then have to be ratified by annual conferences. That's the most challenging part. We have not had good luck ratifying constitutional amendments in the past, and in part because, so the U.S. church is 55% of the votes at General Conference. We're only 45% of the votes for ratification because of the count. Now, there's two reasons for that. One, with disaffiliations, the U.S. has lost 25% of our churches. Well, the General Conference did not take away 25% of our votes. So we have 25% higher vote count than we should have based on the formula for this General Conference only. The other piece that I mentioned is we have stepped in the count from the global church, so it's less represented. Well, that full representation will be enforced during the vote for ratification because it's votes by annual conferences. So the U.S. is 55% of the votes of this General Conference, but for ratification will be closer to 45%. So there's either a consensus outside the United States for regionalization or it cannot happen. Mm-hmm. I do believe there's consensus in the U.S. for regionalization. All 5 jurisdictional conferences passed aspirational resolutions at the 80th percentile 2 years ago, year and a half ago. We have seen some of that with Europe, and we've seen some of that in the Philippines. We've not seen any annual conferences in Africa vote aspirationally. We've seen some delegates vote that way, but we haven't seen annual conferences vote that way. So regionalization is a puzzle, and we need to get to two-thirds at General Conference and again at ratification.
So let's talk about the two-thirds vote, because it doesn't work quite the same way as like a U.S. constitutional amendment where it's like the states ratifying. It's an aggregate vote, right, of all the, of all the members. So for example, to keep the math easy, 300, let's say there's 300 votes in the Great Plains Conference, and there's 300 votes in the Congo. To get to that number, you'd have to have 400, right, of those 600 votes.
That's right.
But we could have all 300 of the people in the Great Plains approve it if only 99 do in the Congo, where one vote
that's
short.
Right. And we saw that in 2016, we passed a really radical constitutional amendment that said women are equal to men in the eyes of God. That passed with a two-thirds vote at General Conference, and it failed to be ratified. And it failed to be ratified in part because the WCA and the Global Methodist Church, that group, have labeled every vote at General Conference as a proxy vote on homosexuality. And so they were able to sabotage overseas, primarily in Africa, the vote on women as the first step towards approving homosexuality. And so these are part of the lies that are being told actively by that Reform and Renewal, they call themselves Reform and Renewal Coalition, that have sabotaged previous votes, and they're actively sabotaging regionalization as we speak here today.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, the regionalization that's a term that might not be familiar with a lot of people, but if they've paid attention, especially the last, I'd say, 6 months or so, it's really, in my opinion, it seems to have risen in the list of priorities for a lot of people, because I think folks are starting to understand the importance of it as a long-term, not just solution to the current problems that we're having in living in unity, but in anticipation of possible things that we haven't even thought of yet 10, 20, 50 years down the road as a denomination. I think that's important for people to understand that this is an opportunity to move past the hurdles and get into something that gives us a real chance to move forward and focus on discipleship moving forward instead of some of these things that divide us.
Well, that's right. And I think the elephant in the room at General Conference is the reality that 99.4% of every dollar that goes to the global church comes from the U.S. churches. And when the U.S. church no longer has a majority vote to have a say in how that money is spent, it's going to be a crisis. It's already a bit of a crisis, but it's going to be a crisis. And the U.S. church has taken a beating between COVID-19 and disaffiliations. They're presenting the GCFA, the General Council on Finance and Administration for the General Church, is recommending a 42% cut to the budget at General Conference.
That's compared to the 2016 budget, which is the last time we've had a General Conference. So
that's the dealt with budget.
Just dealt with the budget, just so folks understand that that's quite a span, but it's still a huge chunk of money. Even if you, if I understand it correctly, I read something not too long ago that even if you take into account incremental things, it's still a 17% thereabouts decrease. So this is still a huge, huge cut no matter what you look at. But it's a really impressive number when you go back to the last time we dealt with the budget in 2016.
That's right. That's right. And I think the regionalization gives us a path to where the U.S. church will feel more comfortable with the decisions moving forward.
Let's talk about some of the other components. We talked about removing the restrictive language.
Yeah.
That's something that I know has been a passion of yours. I've seen you stand at General Conference and speak passionately about this. How do you feel about the chances of that happening this time? And if that is something maybe you think is going to happen, what's been the tide that turned it?
That's a great question. The tide turned in 2019. The One Church plan was a major compromise for both sides to say, we're willing to live with one another, and you can be conservative, others can be progressive, the centrists can stay in the middle. And it, really the group that rejected that were the traditionalists. And they rejected the One Church plan and instead passed the traditional plan, which was an anathema to the U.S. church. Only a third of the delegates in the U.S. supported that, the traditional plan. And in fact, 60% of the votes that passed the traditional plan came from outside the United States, mostly from Africa. And so there are many of us who feel like it was imposed upon us and limiting our ability to reach our mission field. And it basically attacks gay people and their allies. And that's been going on really since 1972. 1972 is when the incompatibility language was inserted into the social principles. And then the marriage prohibitions have been added, the ordination prohibitions, the funding prohibitions. And the funding prohibition, just to give you an example, in 2016, there was a petition before the General Conference in committee that said the church should work to support gay teens to prevent gay suicide among gay teens. Well, that failed. That petition failed because there's a funding ban. Now, I'm just going to tell you, if the church isn't working against suicide for anybody, what are we doing as a church? I mean, we just need to close our doors and go home. If we're not working to prevent suicide with gay teens, we're not being the church. So people were incensed that that failed. And again, it was that same far-right group in the United States, these well-funded groups that made it a proxy vote. You know, you can't support anything pro-gay. It's just outrageous, the lies that were told to make that happen. But folks were very upset, and I think the traditional plan ramped up the harm and the punitive measures, both for gay people and their allies. And there was a huge backlash in the U.S. right afterwards. I say the traditionalists in the U.S. won the vote and lost the church. And in the annual conferences that spring and summer, after that vote in February of 2019, there was a backlash where the votes went from two-thirds of the U.S. supporting inclusion to 75%. And we've seen that play out with the disaffiliations. About 75% mm-hmm. are still here, wanting to move forward as a church. And that that removal of the language is critical. The challenge we have is making it clear that regions are going to be able to make their own decisions. We have no question that Africa is not going to ordain gay pastors, even if the discipline said they had to. Mm-hmm. The U.S. is not going to stop ordaining gay pastors, even if we're told we can't. And so we're at an impasse, and this is why one of the reasons, this is one of the presenting issues why we need regionalization. But as you mentioned, there are other issues that will come down the pike that we just, the it's a governance structure issue. Basically, the U.S. was told, you have to spend your resources on trials that you don't even want to have. Well, we're not spending our resources on trials anymore in the U.S. We're done. So we have to remove that restrictive language. And the good news is we likely have the votes because it only requires a majority vote. So the math goes like this. We lost the one church plan by 50 votes. Traditional plan passed by 50 votes. We needed 26 people to change their mind. Well, we picked up more than 26 votes in the elections in 2019 following that.
I was going to say another presentation of the backlash, if you want to call it that, was, dare I say, the elections of delegates to what was going to be the 2020. By the way, if you want to go back in time, this is actually the 2020 General Conference.
That's right. No, that's exactly
it's
right.
It's happening in 2024, but this is to the postponed 2020 General Conference. Now, I am not a super insider like you are with the denomination, but I've been around long enough to know the names of some of the people who were elected this time around.
That's right.
And they were vastly different.
That's right.
Than the folks who were there before.
That's right. And I think that there was a real push to organize elections to have centrist and progressives elected. That's big. So we picked up 26 votes then. The next piece was with disaffiliations. Because most traditionalists had the integrity to resign from their delegations when they joined the GMC, we picked up more votes there. We have an entirely centrist and progressive delegation out of Alabama, which is 180 degrees.
That's mind-blowing.
180 degrees
before.
Post-disaffiliations. So between the backlash in 2019 and disaffiliations, we have more than picked up the votes we need to remove the language. Now, the rub comes because it makes regionalization all the more important. And so we're trying to work with our allies in Africa and the Philippines to make sure that our urgency to remove the language. Now, we're just removing the language. We're not adding any affirmative language for LGBTQ persons. That's an important difference.
Right. It's not like the pendulum is swinging completely a different direction. We're just moving it. We want to move it back to what it was pre-1972.
That's exactly right. That's right. So it's just a reset, and then leave it to the regions. If they want to add other restrictions, they will be able to do so. So that's the big piece about removing the language. I think it's likely. I'll believe it when I see it. But I do think that if we don't, we've grieved the 25% loss on the right from disaffiliations. We forget that we've lost at least that many from the left through the years over the last generation, not having a neutral position. So the exodus on the left will accelerate dramatically if we don't remove the language. And if there's no path, if regionalization fails and we don't remove the language, I think a lot of folks in the U.S. are going to say, what are we doing here?
Mm-hmm. We're going to come back to that in just a moment. I want to kind of finish up the priorities.
Yep.
So we've gone through two. Give us your third one. I know there's an A to B to it. So I'll let you talk about those briefly, and then we're going to get back to what you were just talking about.
So regionalization, removing the language, the revised social principles, has undergone an 8-year process of revision. It removes the incompatibility language, and it removes the definition of marriage as one man and one woman. There's a significant rub there with our delegates in Africa. But revised social principles, and then removing the other 10 paragraphs of harm. Our third priority is stopping disaffiliations. Great Plains went through a process. It was a fair process. Churches that wanted to disaffiliate did. I think every church that's anti-gay has left. We had a lot of collateral damage nationwide of churches that don't really care about gay issues, but really just were opportunists and wanted their churches and their properties. They didn't join the Global Methodist Church. I don't know the number. It's half or less that have joined the Global Methodist Church. And particularly the largest churches that left, many of them have gone independent. And so stopping this disaffiliation, it's already in the discipline. We don't need to reopen it. Let annual conferences deal with it at a local level, and that is both in the United States and globally. There's no reason for the General Conference to wade into this again.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back to what you were just talking about a few minutes ago. If these things don't happen,
right,
there's going to be ramifications.
That's right.
I would argue we've made, and you alluded to this, we have a generation, I would argue two generations, that have kind of left the church. My generation, I'm a Gen Xer. I believe you are too. Two Xers here. We were a couple of the rare ones in that we stuck around. You're really rare because you're a pastor and multi-generations.
Yes.
But I have siblings that maybe walk in the church twice a year, Christmas and Easter. Not so much, honestly, with some of them. And then our kids. Now, both of my kids, I've been lucky. I've got one who's going to be commissioned at annual conference this year as a provisional elder, and then another one who is serving on her church council in Colorado Springs. That's been a blessing for us to see both of them stay engaged, but we know that that's not the norm.
That's right.
For the 20-somethings. If these things don't happen at General Conference, we have the potential of losing even more. And I know that you, I so appreciated a presentation you gave at Topeka First United Methodist Church. I was not able to attend because some other things going on, but I watched the live stream.
Okay.
And toward the end, somebody asked that question, I believe, and you gave kind of we're trying to formulate a plan B.
Right.
I think it's only fair for people to understand what that might be, because if it comes to that, things would be changing dramatically.
That's right. I think we have gone as far as we can with global governance. In 2012, we agreed that the majority U.S. was not going to control the minority outside the United States. And now the shoe is on the other foot. And I say it this way. I don't know how many Americans you know, but the Americans I know are not very willing to feel like they're being controlled by others. And I don't know any group of Americans that are liberal enough or conservative enough to turn over their checkbook to others. And so there's a crisis afoot, and we need to be clear about that. And there's no going back. The status quo is not an option. The U.S. continuing to just ignore the provisions and the discipline is not a sustainable model. We just need to move forward. My concern is if all this fails and we walk away from General Conference with nothing, the U.S. church is going to take a long, hard look about what we're doing. And I think there may be a movement to do what is already working for the Lutherans, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, UCC. It doesn't have to be mean-spirited. It's just a reality that a U.S.-based church allows everybody to be who they are and allows us to stay in mission together. So if regionalization doesn't pass, I think autonomy for the U.S. churches is a live option. And it's not an option that anybody's excited about, but it becomes just the reality one way or another. And whether it's because of, again, human sexuality is the face of the issue right now, but the imbalance right now with resources is the elephant in the room. So I do think that there would be a massive exodus on the left. If this doesn't pass, it could be entire annual conferences and jurisdictions. And there could be an awareness from the rest of the U.S. church to say, we don't want that. We're going to find a way to stay together in the U.S., even if we can't stay together globally. Mm-hmm. But the status quo is over. It's finished. It's not coming back. And we're moving forward. And forward, the best option in my mind is through regionalization. Should that fail, the U.S. church is going to continue to move forward. And so is the church around the world. The good news, and this is my hope, the good news is the church of Jesus Christ has endured 2,000 years of human occupation.
Kicking and screaming, yes.
That's right. I trust it will endure 2,000 more. And my father is fond of saying, Ron Holland, who's retired Great Plains United Methodist, is fond of saying that the history of the church is written in centuries, not decades. And we've had a tough couple decades here with the church, but we have an opportunity to set the foundation for the next century of Methodism in the United States and hopefully around the world. So I'm optimistic that we will move forward. The question is, how painful is it going to be? And it'd be nice to have a consensus worldwide that we want to work together in regionalization. If we don't have that consensus, we don't have it.
Right. So those types of words may be concerning for some folks, but at the tail end of the presentation that I watched from Topeka First, a couple of folks asked you some pointed questions that I thought you gave excellent answers to.
Okay.
The first one I want to get to is, I believe a person stood up and said they were part of a conservative church. What do they do if all these things happen? And I thought you gave a great answer.
You keep being conservative. You reach your mission field. If you're in a conservative area, and many of our churches are, you need to be who you are, and you need to keep doing what you're doing. I've had conservative churches say to me, you know, as I've done these presentations around, they're like, "Well, we're going to get a gay pastor." To which I say, "Good news and bad news. The good news is no gay pastor wants to come to your church, and the bad news is there just aren't enough gay pastors to go around. Not everybody gets one." So the reality
is... There is this misnomer that there's just a ton of gay people that are serving in pastoral roles, and that's not... First of all, the cabinet. So I'm not on the cabinet. Full disclosure, folks, I'm not on the cabinet. I'm happy not to be on the cabinet.
Many of us give
thanks every day for not being on the cabinet. But I will tell you this. The cabinet works so hard to try to match people to the church because they want the church to be successful.
That's exactly right.
They're not going to put somebody there on purpose to cause strife and unrest.
That's right.
And people just seem to be lost in this narrative that that's what's going to happen. And I can't think of a single scenario. And keep in mind, I've worked for Scott Jones, I've worked for Bishop Sines, and now with Bishop Wilson. None of those three people would do that.
That's right. Well, and I think the key that you said is we all want the churches to be successful. If you're in a conservative church, you need to keep being conservative and you need to keep reaching your mission field. There's nothing wrong with that. What we're also saying is imposing conservative values on a church whose mission field is not conservative is eminently problematic. And it's harming our urban churches. It's harming our progressive churches. It's harming our centrist churches. So I do think that I think those fears are unwarranted. I think and it does two things. One, it really presents an image of gay people as very negative, which is very problematic. I mean, everyone knows gay people. They may not know that they're gay. Mm-hmm. And I think that the pejorative notion that that gay people are harmful de facto is harmful language in its own right. And the same thing has been done with women. We've ordained women for 70 years. I don't know the number, but I'll bet half the churches in our conference have not had a woman pastor yet. And there's all this fear and trembling. Oh, we can't have a woman pastor, can't have a woman pastor. Oh, it turns out we have a lot of great women pastors. And so what it was pejorative language about women. Once people move through that, recognizing that there are a lot of people who have gifts for ministry. So I do think that my hope for conservative churches is you keep being conservative. And I'm very comfortable being in a church with you. The question is, are you comfortable being in a church with me?
I think we'll let that be the last word. Thanks so much, Mark, for taking time.
Thank you. I appreciate you doing this this podcast.
See, there's a lot to unpack as we prepare for the General Conference. We'll continue this series next time with a discussion with Great Plains Conference lay leader Lisa Maupin. I hope you'll join me to hear what she has to say. In Layman's Terms is a podcast sponsored by the Great Plains Conference of the United Methodist Church and by me, your host, Todd Seifert. If you like what you've heard in this episode, please go rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening. It helps others find us. And if you're so inclined, please share the link to this podcast on your social media channels. Our music and sound effects come via subscriptions to Universal Production Music and to Storyblocks. You can find archived episodes on the conference website at www.greatplainsumc.org/podcasts or on my website, toddseifert.com. Please email me with any questions or comments to tseifert@greatplainsumc.org, and I'll do my best to respond as quickly as possible. Thank you for listening, and until next time, please do what you can to help make more disciples of Jesus Christ. You can play a small part in helping change a life.